philosophers in space, 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 space.
They waste all their choices on the way to us. They want to own the light.
Living in fear of being torn limb from limb by the Minotaur may seem harsh to some people now, but you have to remember what it was like after 9/11.
That's right.
Were you wearing a mask? Were you burned by acid or something like that?
Oh no, it's just they're terribly comfortable. I think everyone will be wearing them in the future.
An animal caught in a trap will gnaw off its own leg to escape. What will you do?
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space, episode 167. Well, it's Dune time again.
Ooh,
how's it going?
Dune. Got to downshift it. Dune. Yeah, it's good, man. How you doing? Let's fulfill some legends.
Yeah, yeah. This is episode at least 4 of Dune-related content.
Yes, if you don't count the one where we did Picard and the Butlerian Jihad, which was a sort of fake, low-key Dune episode.
You squeezed in more Dune-ish content.
A little Dune sneaking.
It's still only once a year, isn't it? I don't know, whatever.
Yeah, I don't know when the next one's going to come out, though we'll obviously be doing the part two for sure. It's exciting.
Yeah, we watched Dune, the new Dune. I wanted to see it in... What am I looking for?
Theaters? You've forgotten the word for theaters?
I wanted IMAX. To say IMDb. Yeah, IMAX.
IMAXDB.
Yeah, IMAX. I wanted to see it in IMAX. Yeah. I just missed it. Like, I literally missed it by a day, and I was like, oh, IMAX, let's do it. And then it was Eternals, and every single IMAX theater in this world was like, Eternals, Eternals,
downgrade.
Eternals. Yeah, I was like, I'm not watching that. I haven't watched it for free,
it comes out on Disney Plus or something.
Yeah, I don't. That one looks not good, but whatever. So I missed it, and then I was like, "Well, I'll see it in theaters." And then I just ran out of time and had to watch it on HBO. I've seen other people complain about this too. Like the HBO app for some reason on Dune doesn't work. Did you watch it on that? Because it just.
I watched it on HBO Max and I watched it at IMAX. I got both experiences.
Both maxes. Yeah, you maxed out.
I maxed out.
Min-maxer.
I'm full max. Yeah. I'm a max maxer.
It crashed a million times while I was trying to watch it on the stupid app.
Weird. Anyway. That's annoying.
Yeah, I had to like go. By crash, I mean like it would do the loading thing, but never. You have to like rewind or fast forward a frame or two to get out of it. You know, it's like it just gets stuck.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I'm sad you didn't get to see it in IMAX because I felt like it was one of the few occasions where the audio experience was different, like significantly different, especially with how they did the voice. I felt like you would have had appreciated that. They did this really cool thing where, like, you know, they used the, like, subwoofers to, like, shake the room before you hear the voice. And so it, like, your body is, like, vibrated a little bit and then the sound comes through. It was very cool.
Yeah. Did you get him the water? Did you give him his water?
Oh, I for sure handed them the
every
water.
Every single
absolutely.
Person in the theater is, like,
just holds up water.
A drink. Yeah.
Yeah. That's how it works. You got to pitch it to a specific person at a time. Come on. Let's be, you know, precise here.
Okay.
you can't just fool around. There are rules.
Yeah. So, I thought this movie, I guess, you know, exposition wise, since we've already explained Dune a number of times, I don't know. What's our plan here?
I think we should talk about, you know, I was curious to hear your experience of this one versus the Lynch one. And I'm happy to share a couple of my sort of favorite moments in this one, especially things that they added that I thought were like cool improvements to the book. I will say I got to spend a good 3 to 7 hours, I think, on This Film Is Lit talking about this movie. They had me on to like go through detailed Dune.
Oh, wow.
So I got a good bit of it out of my system. So I'm happy to share some key highlights here. And like, we didn't talk much about the philosophy over there. So we'll have plenty of that to do over here.
All right. Well, in that case, I think we'd better bop it.
Bop it!
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement. Between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
this is a beautiful movie. Like the looks wise,
mm-hmm. better than Lynch.
Well, I mean, it's hard to compare a movie from 90 something. I don't know.
But to be fair, the artistic design of the Lynch one is not its weak point, right? You can complain about I thought pacing it was super or something like that. Yeah. Right. It looks good. It looks cool.
You know what? I had a thought, and I don't know if this applies to more than just this movie, but I realized, I was watching, I was like, you know, it was beautiful. I actually had Lydia watch it, and then, you know, probably like 75% of the way through, there wasn't much going on for her. So, but I realized,
is that right around a certain individual dies? Is that what you mean?
No, that too, but also it's just, I don't know. There's not mm-hmm. that much that goes on in this movie, to be honest with you. We'll talk about it, but it's hateful. A beautiful movie.
That's a hateful statement to make given how much they packed into this movie.
I've realized that when it comes to sci-fi, partway through the movie, I just had this realization that, like, when it comes to good sci-fi and looking like futury and cool and great, I realized, like, the ships don't matter anymore. You know, like, it used to just be like, well, you just the spaceship. That's the thing that mattered. Like, you spaceship right. movie. Get your spaceship in there. Beep, boop, boop. Cool.
Gotta have that fancy model.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I've realized, like, it's everything but that now. Like, because the CGI spaceship, you're like, yeah, everybody has, you know, CGI spaceship. Everybody's got that. But it's the set dressing. And
three,
like,
of them in my garage right now.
Yeah. It's the sets. It's the costuming. It's all mm-hmm. that stuff mm-hmm. now that I'm realizing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that was always true, but I don't know. Just for me, watching this movie, I was like, that's what makes this super duper cool. No longer does the spaceship really do much for me because I've seen a million CGI spaceships now.
Yeah, and I think, so like, for example, compare it to the opening shot of Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Where you have that giant ship come flying. Yeah, balls, no, yeah. And of course, that is, in many ways, like, you don't have Star Wars without Dune, right? Like, they're very similar on a lot of points. But I agree with you. I do think that, like, even in the David Lynch version, like, the focus on those big models of the different ships and things compared to here, where, like, the ships look cool, and you do have that shot of, like, for some reason on, you know, House Emo, they keep their ships underwater, which, like, I don't understand why that would ever be an efficient place to keep your ships.
I hate how they did that in one of the new Star Trek,
so they can
too,
fly about out
where
the water,
Enterprise just pops out of the water. You're like, a spaceship is made out of tin foil. Like, I get that we're in a different world, but, like, it's the total opposite of what you want. In space, yep. you get to take advantage of the fact that you don't actually need that level of material, nope. you know, because there's not a lot.
Yep. Yeah, we're water people, so we keep our ships underwater. No, but I agree with you. Like,
there's
what
a reason
really...
submarines are like those, you know, freaking cast iron, whatever, you know, the giant thingies. Like, that's the opposite of what a spaceship needs to be. Anyway.
But what worked, I thought, on this one was especially a lot of the bug-based sort of airplane architecture, thopters.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, they're called dragon, yeah, they're called thopters, but they look like dragonflies, right, in this one, which I think is an homage to the Yordowski version that was never made, where they had talked about using sort of that kind of design.
There's,
and it's very similar
there's
to what's
also
described in the book.
Some number of Miyazaki movies that have that exact
sure
as well.
Sure. Obviously, for sure. But I thought they looked really good. Like, once you sort of suspend disbelief that that's a physically possible way to fly, right, like, it looked cool and it worked well and it was enjoyable to watch. And there were, like, several other sort of buggy based things throughout the movie that I thought was a good kind of motif to add in.
Yeah, what a cast too. Interesting cast.
Mm-hmm.
We were watching and I saw that Harkonnen and I was like, that's a Skarsgård. And then my wife didn't believe me because she never does, but I always end up being right. And then we had the whole thing where we did some research of, like, wait a minute, is it Sarsgaard or Skarsgård? I was asking her, I was like, is it Sarsgaard or Skarsgård?
Then
she literally Googled it and, like, an article comes up that's like, do you know your Sarsgaards versus Skarsgaards or something like that? Because it's
wait,
there is one
of them
that's Sarsgaard and then the others are Skarsgård. And I'm glad I finally, like, got that information because I thought I was just misremembering every single time.
Wait, so which guard is this?
This is Stellan Skarsgård. There's another actor. Oh, here, I'll look him up now because I
really
Alexander Sarsgaard. No, Peter Sarsgaard. There's a Peter Sarsgaard.
Uh-huh.
And there's the rest. I think the rest are Skarsgaards. I don't know.
The problem is these words are almost completely indistinguishable for me in my ear. So like,
I know I'm talking. Saying, I don't know why
you're
I'm
just
even
saying Malkovich over and over again.
This is not a distinction that you need to know. Oh, and
no,
the
no
Sarsguards add an A. So it's essentially they convert the K over to an extra meaningless A. So Sarsguard, you know. So there you go. Okay. Gotcha.
He was doing a really killer Apocalypse Now impression in this movie. I don't know if that come through for you. Is that a reference that resonates for you?
I see it. I see it.
All over. I mean, like patting his head while he's like wet is at the end with Marlon Brando, who also like shows up to Apocalypse Now for filming like substantially heavier than they were expecting him to, and they had to do a lot of like stylized shots to make sure they could sort of hide that fact a little bit. So I really felt they were leaning into, and especially when he comes up out of the liquid later on in the movie, really leaning into that kind of association. And I loved it. I thought it looked so good.
Yeah.
So a couple of things that jumped out to me that were like changes, right? Things that I hadn't seen in previous versions of Dune that I really liked one of the first ones was the covering of Arrakeen. So when you came sort of flying in over Arrakis for the first time, right? And you see the city and it's completely covered. That it's just like this kind of, it sort of had a South American kind of ziggurat vibe almost to it. That's not, as far as I remember, in the book. Like, in the book, it's sort of, it's treated more as just like an Agrabah kind of situation, right? You know, your standard sort of Middle Eastern looking, huts and things like that. But I really liked the idea of changing it to this fully covered city because it made sense in a place where the sun is just so horrible, right? And like everything is so awful to be outside in the sun. You would understand why they would sort of completely cover their city and protect it from, you know, sandstorms and stuff like that.
Yeah, I have no memory of that.
No, it didn't do anything for you?
I don't remember. It's covered? I didn't remember that because they're outside at some point. I don't know. There are some
spots that are like, you know, like the yards that are there, like it's exposed. But yeah, gotcha. Most of the city is sort of beautifully covered.
So we've got some notes on the covering of the...
You know, I mean, like, we don't need to go through the plot.
That's
like,
your first note out
the plot, right?
Off the bat, like, okay, first thing to note.
Well, you know, look, here's
there's
here,
a tarp
look,
covering
you just
the
pointed,
city.
Wait a minute. You just pointed out that, like, the quality of good news sci-fi is not just this giant ships. And this is an example of this for me.
How is it covered? What? I don't remember. Sorry, I totally forget.
It's covered in, I think it's like some, you know, cement or some sort of stone or something like that. So it looks like this giant stone city with like everything
good
covered right up to the palace.
In the masonry. I have long said this. No, I agree. how do you, you know, feel about
it's
Timothée
the
Chalamet Bryson Idaho?
I like Chalamet.
What's his name? I don't know. Peter.
I mean,
no. What's his name?
Right. Paul and Mary.
Yeah. Atreides.
Yeah. No, Mary is his mother, the virgin mother. No, I like Paul. I like Timothy. I think he has a good mix of sort of still being young, but also feeling fairly composed.
He's like 40. But he just looks young because he's tiny.
Okay, whatever. Fine. He just looks young.
No,
but like
really
he
40,
he plays it well. Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, like, I'm happily everybody in this movie is old enough that I don't feel bad about finding them inappropriately attractive.
He's 27, though.
Okay. He's great. Perfect.
I'm 37.
But like when what's his name in Dune in the Lynch version played him, he was probably, he looked like he was like 35 or something. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like he looked as old as his mother, essentially. So like at least Timothy actually looks like something vaguely approaching a young person.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And of course, like, you have to age Paul up, I think, a little bit, because in the sort of original version, like just the things that he's gonna end up doing, it's hard to see. It's hard to expect audiences
how old
to
is
watch
he in
like
the book.
I feel like in the book he's like 15 or 16 or something like that. Like he's fairly young. I could be wrong about that, but like I think he's sort of on the younger end still.
Mm-hmm. The person who played his mom, who by the way is one of my favorites. I thought she was fantastic in this movie. Rebecca Ferguson. I don't think I know her from anything else actually. Oh, she's in a Mission Impossible or two. Anyway,
she's 15 years old. Yep.
She's only 12 years older than Timothée Chalamet, which is funny because you see her, they age her up pretty good in the movie, and then you see her like IMDb photo, and you're like, oh my god, she's like younger than she looks very, very young. That's interesting. I would have had no idea. So that was good makeup and a great performance, I think. I really liked her.
Yeah, and the scenes between the two of them are really good. And the thing I like most about Chalamet, and this was part of like a really good choice on Villanueva's part, which is to really reemphasize the sort of Paul's rejection of the Messiah narrative and the like the schemings of the Bene Gesserits to use the Fremen culture as a protection if like they get, you know, if a Bene Gesserit ever gets stuck on Arrakis and needs to in the situation, right? So that was all the like background stuff, especially in the like tent scene where he's kind of having a freak out, right? And seeing the potential of the Jihad laying out before him. In the original Lynch, in the Lynch movie version, right, they don't do any of that like insightful sort of inverting of the Messiah narrative tropes. It's just a very straightforward like Messiah narrative movie where like he just becomes the Messiah and like saves the people. But like the original character doesn't want any of this, right? His like strongest motivation is I would rather not turn into a blood god for whom the Fremen go across the universe murdering a bunch of people, which unfortunately is basically what happens for him. So that's, yeah, like nobody gets what they want in this world. But like I thought that Chalamet did a good job in those particular scenes. I thought that he did a decent job in the like the combat and stuff. He looks pretty good. So yeah, I was happy with him. I don't think there were any performances in this movie that I was unhappy with. Like I feel like everybody was really pulling their weight. Other things that I really liked, and this is sort of not diverting. This is going back to the book more rather than like the Lynch did, which is the centering of the what we're going to talk about in the philosophy, the kind of decolonial elements of the Fremen as this oppressed and marginalized people who are sort of fighting for freedom and the right, you know, the ability to survive, and the way that the conflicts between the houses kind of represent the interest convergence going on between white people over top of that like basic attempt for survival by these people of color. So I liked the way that they started the movie with Zendaya talking about the Fremen. I thought that was a good change. I thought all of like the portrayals of the Fremen, especially Javier Bardem as Stilgar, was exceptionally well done. Like, I just
totally
thought he really
missed that he was in this movie.
He was so good, right?
Was
you
he?
Didn't even realize it was him.
I don't know. I might have. How much was he in it? It wasn't very much, was it?
He's got like two really great scenes. Yeah. Something like that.
Boy, I missed that, which is weird because I always recognize people, but I don't know.
He's the guy who comes in and spits on the floor when he comes and sees the.
Yeah. That's so funny.
Atreides.
Yeah, I see it now, but like, yeah, I totally missed that.
He was so good in that scene. He just felt like so perfectly, awkwardly, yet confidently Fremen. And I liked all of that very much. One other thing that you probably, I'm just listing things that you probably didn't catch at this point, was the part where at the Sandcrawler, when they're trying to save the people and he has that hallucinatory experience, the effect of like the dust getting picked up and like blowing all of that spice right into his face in that kind of way was a great image to me of like getting dosed, essentially, right? Like the experience of getting way more than you wanted out of a particular experience. And then the line that he says there, which I don't even know if you caught it, but he whispers something like, "I recognize your footsteps, old man," which is callback.
I did catch that. Yeah, no, I like that.
Yeah, well, I wanted to add another layer on there for
you. With Thanos.
Yes, with Gurney, right? Gurney Thanos. It was a callback to that, but it was also a double reference because the sandworm is one of the names for Shai Hulud is the old man of the desert. So it was a bit of a I recognize you because I'm part of this world kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which I thought was very clever and like not from the original in any way. And so like added in. Yeah, there were several points where I thought they did a good job sort of going above and beyond even what was in the book. So another one would be Liette Kynes, the black lady who or Arbiter of the Change character.
Interesting character. So she's like neutral allegedly, but is like overseeing the transition of power for the emperor, kind of. That's
right.
As in someone who doesn't know the book, that was the impression I got. Is that what she was doing?
Yeah, basically. So the first level of her job is that she's like, first of all, her title is planetary ecologist. So her primary interest is in the like ecology side of things.
Yeah.
She is there serving in the role of the arbiter of the change from the transition between the Harkonnens and the Atreides. In the book, she is a white dude. That, first of all, I thought was a substantial improvement on the character, the way that they switched her up. And like the other layer of her is that what she really is effectively one of, if not maybe the head leader of the Fremen. As she mentions, like she's welcome in Sieges as well. She is part of the Fremen's
spoilers.
No,
I'm just kidding.
She says this, right? Oh, she says this at the end of the movie. Yeah, yeah. you understand. I think you find out more about this probably in the second one. But like, yeah, she is connected to the Fremen fairly substantially.
It seemed to be hinting at that a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't remember she actually.
I don't know if they're going to do more of that in the second one. But the coolest part was the change to her death. Right, in the book, she just goes back to the Harkonnens. He just goes back to the Harkonnens and tries to like pretend that they weren't, you know, in any way providing aid to the Atreides, but the Harkonnens know otherwise. And so the Harkonnens like drop Liette in the desert with a broken still suit, basically, and he dies in a sand burst and like a spice blow, which is an explosion that happens prior to the spice patches arising and then getting mined. It's a kind of weaker death for him in the book. And like, there's some cool discussion in that chapter between him and this like hallucination of his father, who was another of these like planetary ecologists, talking about like the whole great plan of terraforming Arrakis, right? Trying to turn Arrakis into a paradise. Which was basically sort of Liette's goal, and you know, we'll probably see more of is the goal of the Fremen, right? I think it's mentioned in this story, in the part one at least, that they were sort of trying to make it a paradise for their people.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't want, and is that because like obviously better, you know, the more hospitable living conditions, but also then they wouldn't have people fighting over the spice all the time on their planet?
Yeah, it's complicated, and it's some of both, right? The one thing is wanting your children to wander around during the day without a still suit, right? That's sort of described as one goal, right? But the other is right to not be sort of a target of constant like exploitation and marginalization. But I say it's complicated because their religion is also closely connected to Shai-Hulud and the worms, and it's not clear that those things can coexist. So there is a tension within the Fremen dream of what they are trying to accomplish, which is an important key point for what we're going to be discussing here in a second about decolonialism, which is how do we give the Fremen what they want, especially if what they want might be internally inconsistent or something like that.
Already, why are we in a position of giving the Fremen what they want?
Exactly. That's another good question. Yep. All good questions that we will get to here momentarily. But like, I like that they changed Liette's death where the Sardaukar stab her and then she kills them with the sandworm. That was a very cool way. And like that sort of moment of conveying that like her true allegiance in all of this is always been to the Fremen and Shai-Hulud.
The Sardaukar? Like, you know, sorry, I don't remember what that is.
The Sardaukar are the super powerful soldiers. So the guys who were standing around during the chant, right, who had the like Rick and Morty blood sacrifice going on in the background, who are alongside, like up against the Fremen are the two best sort of fighting forces in the universe, and who were sort of secretly given to the Harkonnen as a way to defeat the Atreides.
Okay, I was
going to
say, so the Harkonnen was, I thought, I assumed those were just Harkonnens or something. I didn't know that that was
separate. They belong to the Emperor. And so like the secret machinations in all of this is the Harkonnen are backed secretly by the Emperor, who gives them, you know, three legions of his Sardaukar death troops.
Right.
Who are,
I will give this movie credit for explaining this pretty decently to someone like me who hasn't read the books and is honestly not really into Dune. But like because they did enough of that where it's like, you know, okay, sure, on paper, what the Emperor is like, you know, rewarding the House Atreides with this planet, but actually it could be more of a curse. And so then so it sounds like that all came through well, because that was what I was given the impression of, that the Emperor actually was still kind of backing the Harkonnens.
Yeah, exactly. So, I think they did a really good job of sort of conveying that. Though it's always funny to me, because it always kind of feels a little bit like, you know, we have all this clever setup, but we know it's a trap, right? And the first way to avoid a trap is to know it's a trap. And then they show up and just get stomped. Like, there's no clever turnaround from the Atreides because they knew that it was a trap. They just get murdered. So, like, I thought that's just kind of like a funny part of Dune to me. Other things maybe that you caught.
I love doing this recording because I figure that 90% of our audience has a PhD in Dune. And I'm just sitting here I watched a movie.
There were worms, I think. I also liked about Liad's death that it sort of foreshadowed the riding of the worms, right? Because you see those maker hooks come out as she's, you know, but if you don't know what's going on, you might necessarily not know why, but you'll find out later that, like, that's the tool they use to ride worms.
I assumed it was a sex thing.
Yeah, of course you did. That's an After Dark joke. So let's see. Oh, the other thing that really did it for me, which was probably not necessarily clear if you haven't read the book, but I thought was still a good scene anyway, was the scene with the shout-out Mape, the servant who offers the blade to Jessica. You remember that sequence?
Kinda.
Oh, vaguely. Yeah. So there's a really cool thing that they managed to fit in there, which is... in the book, right? This is another example where she, as a Bene Gesserit, is trying to rely on their seeding of mythology into these traditions as a way to, like, prepare the way for her, to make her life easier, essentially. And so she's this shout-out Mabe asks her, or, like, you know, reveals this dagger and asks her what it is, and she knows it's a test, right? And so she's, like, trying to figure out what she's going to say to try to prove that she is the mythic figure from their stories. Mm. And what she's actually going to say, she thinks, is it's a maker of death, right? That's what she's going for. But all she gets out is a maker, and then the shout-out Mabe screams because she thinks what she's referring to is, again, Shai Hulud, one of his other names is the maker. You catch this when Liet Kynes is praying, you know, bless the maker and his water, bless his coming and going, may he cleanse the world with his passage. And I just thought they did a beautiful job in that scene, sort of capturing Jessica's sort of surprise at the response, but also the ability to sort of quickly, you know, react quickly enough to know that she's done what she needs to do and, like, let it be this kind of effective moment.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's all over my head.
Yeah, but if you go back and watch, you can sort of see it.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, a lot of, like you say, a lot of our folks have PhDs in this.
I've been waiting to ask you, why is he named Duncan Idaho? Like, what?
Because he's
Duncan
so cool.
Idaho.
Well, look, let me be
clear.
Hold
on, let me go through some of the names. Paul Atreides, Thufir, Hawat, Stilgar.
Yep.
Let's see, Harkonnen. We got Gurney Halleck. Duke Leto Atreides, you know, and Duncan Idaho. What?
Yep. No joke. These people come from Earth originally, right?
Yeah.
Like, this world does
originate
from Earth.
Also, it had to be Jason Momoa named Duncan Idaho.
I know. It's so great.
It sounds like you should have a cowboy hat on and, like, I don't know. It's weird.
Yeah, I mean, my understanding is what Herbert was going for is that these names reflect the different sort of... colonial versus colonized areas of Earth where these people are originating from. So whereas the Fremen are the descendants of this group called the Wandering Zensunis, I actually looked this up, who originate from originally the Nile Valley in Africa, you know, the impression is you get is that like the Atreides are your sort of Northern Europeans or something like that, right? And the Harkonnens are some other Northern Europeans.
Wait, the Harkonnens are from Earth? That big slug guy is somehow from Earth?
I mean, yeah, they're all original. They're all humans. There's no aliens in this movie.
What? Oh, I totally thought they were aliens. Sorry.
No. The closest thing you get is that weird creature that the Baron has, which I think, and they don't explain this, is maybe, and so like, I'm gonna butcher this name, but the way it was pronounced in the Lynch version is the Benny Lilacs, which are like man machine kinds of things, and they make weird creatures, and that might have been what that thing was, and that's possibly a setup for the third movie, because it's possible that he's gonna be doing Dune Messiah, in which they figure more prominently.
Oh, all right, well, so. I missed that. I thought these were
just
different aliens.
Just doing
planets.
Some setup. Just doing some setup, you know. So, yeah, I guess should we talk some philosophy? I think we're...
Yeah, well, I want to offer a thought or two.
Okay.
I think that this was probably a good movie for Dune fans, but...
Uh-huh.
If, you know, but in the end, like, as a not book reader, this was a weird movie. Like, it ended... Really? Bizarrely, like, you know, it got me.
Okay, I didn't know it was gonna be.
It got me kind of into the intrigue. I was like, okay, I think I understand what's going on here. We got Oscar Isaac, and that part was cool, what he did, and then I kind of got it. And then the movie's just like, dude riding a sandworm, cut, done. And you're just like, what? How is that the ending of this movie? Like, they didn't. I feel like there wasn't enough of a, you know, like an act one or whatever, like enough of a climax for a part one. Is all I'm saying. Like it.
Interesting.
It feels like it should be a TV series. Yeah, but
is a TVC version. There is a TVC sci-fi version that I will not make you watch because you know I want to stay friends.
I mean, I think it'll be good. I think it'll probably work as a movie series. You know, when they're all out, but it did. This one didn't. It didn't have the like when you think about a part one of like any of the Star Warses or any of the something where you know you're making multiples. It still has a conflict and a resolution and a climax in a way that I don't know. It was. It was just weird.
I guess I disagree. I feel like from the attack by the Harkonnens through to, you know, Paul's fight.
I'm not saying
fight.
It didn't have anything. I'm just saying that it didn't have it in the way that normally a movie would. It had it in a way of like, oh, can't wait to the next episode where I find out what goes on with
well,
that.
Well, yeah, you know I mean, it is a part one. But yeah, I also really liked the Fremen, like the last shot being the Fremen riding the sandworm. That is a reference to a scene that happens literally halfway through the book where she, you know, they still don't know at this point that the Fremen ride sandworms. And like Jessica is the one who sees it, but she thinks it's basically a mirage. Like she thinks she sees a mirage of a worm with like Fremen cloaks on its back. But I thought they were sort of doing a nice allusion.
What if the sandworm dives into the sand? Are you just...
Well, that's the point of the hooks is that it keeps the plates open so they don't dive.
Plates?
Okay. Yeah, they have plates.
So I don't understand
their
the
sides.
Mechanics of sandworms.
Don't you worry. The next movie we'll explain them. We'll explain the mechanics.
All
of
right.
Sandworm
well, I've registered
riding.
My opinion. That's but yeah, no. So it was. I don't know. In the end, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. It was good. It was fun to look at, but it was weird. Anyway, all right.
Okay.
Opinion registered. Let's move on.
All right. Fair enough.
Why don't we grok it?
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
Yeah, so let's talk some decolonialism. So we've mentioned this term before, and like mostly we talked about post-colonialism up to this point, and I want to try to distinguish between them a little bit, and then we'll dive into how it applies here. Now, these are both contested broad terms, so like obviously these are, you know, explanation is up for debate, right? But broadly speaking, as I've come to understand it, post-colonialism is basically more of like an analysis of the colonial model that sort of takes place, you know, after sort of the rejection, broadly speaking, of colonial projects, even though we kind of continue to do all of them, right? But like, it was mostly about understanding the system itself, where decolonialism has taken that and sort of added to it the specific desire to deconstruct and like a focus on the process, potentially violent process of deconstructing colonialism. So just for folks who are curious, who've heard, you know, maybe both those terms, I think in practice, people often use these synonymously or in a not sort of consistent kind of way. But like my understanding of the literature is that that's sort of how it goes, if that makes sense.
All right.
So like, for example, someone like Walensky, when I talk about Learning to Divide the World, is, I think, an educator who draws heavily from post-colonial traditions. And there's probably some bleeding from one tradition to the other. But basically, you know, we're interested in this question of how do we undo colonialism? And I think, you know, talking about the Fremen, I think we have this very interesting sort of case study in the challenges to this particular kind of idea, because sort of as we were alluding to in the exposition zone, it's not entirely clear what it looks like to undo sort of hundreds of years, or in this case, you know, many, many, many hundreds of years, thousands of years of cultural oppression and marginalization, and also sort of messing with cultures in these kind of ways, right? So, you know, some ideas that come along that people suggest as like, here's what are the goals of decolonialism are things like, focusing more on indigenous knowledge, right? So you've seen this coming up in the like culture war stuff about different ways of knowing that can often be referring to indigenous ways of knowing. Things like indigenous utopianism, this sort of idea of trying to criticize traditional progressive assumptions of what the goal should be for our lives in the future, and sort of moving back towards like potentially indigenous approaches to ways of living, and then sort of the idea of self-determination, right? So when you were asking like, why do we get to choose what happens to the Fremen, right? Well, a big part of this is about like, how do we make it so that like we're not the ones that are choosing what happens to these colonized kinds of groups, right? But like all of these ideas bring with them sort of significant challenges. Does that make sense so far?
Yeah.
So like, let's talk about these in particular a little bit, right? So we have indigenous knowledge or alternative ways of knowing, right? You know, I've done a lot of reading in the past year and a half in particular on like standpoint epistemology and alternative ways of knowing. And you know, I tend to be very sympathetic to the parts of these approaches that are about sort of criticizing simplistic rationalism or simplistic sort of scientism or you know, like overly emphasized Western ways of knowing or something like that. But I feel like there are real threats of like cultural relativism, epistemic cultural relativism that are lurking in the background of these discussions. And I genuinely worry that some of the work in these areas is not taking those problems seriously enough, yeah, or mentions them,
well,
but doesn't.
I just ask the question, what the hell is an alternate way of knowing, and why right. wouldn't there just be knowing, and then whatever the way is, then you know something, and that goes into science or whatever
right,
the field is.
Right. How does this not end up being like alternative medicine or something, right? Which I think is a very reasonable concern, especially in, like when this stuff, I think, when indigenous knowledge, or especially what Western people think indigenous knowledge is, can be so frequently and easily, you know, like co-opted into, you know, making medical alternative medicine or like alternative health or wellness, all that kind of stuff, right? You know, to tie this back to the movie, right? What does it mean to allow sort of self-determination for the Fremen when we know for a fact that, like, the Fremen culture has been A, heavily determined by violent survival for hundreds of years, that, like, it's sort of that, that's been its defining feature in this kind of way, and that has shaped its honor culture, right, shaped its approach in these things, but it's also been heavily influenced by the meddling of what in this universe is effectively, right, your Western religion, right, in terms of incepting their own mythology, their messianic narratives into this culture, right? How do you respect Fremen ways of knowing while preserving all of those things and not and thereby sort of reproduce, I think, problematic ways of knowing? It's not very clear to me, right? I don't think there's
any ways of knowing that. I'm sorry, I don't know what that means in that context.
Yes, I mean, there could be a couple of ways to cash out this idea, and I'm sort of dodging because I feel like I've read a lot of this stuff, but don't feel like I have a comfortable answer to this question. The ways that I've understood it have been things like a shift from atomism to holism, as we've talked about before, right? So, like, Western scientific approaches overemphasize atomistic approaches, right? Divide things down to their composite parts, understand the composite parts, and you'll understand the whole, right? That's one way of understanding, like, Western scientific method, quote unquote, right? And so an alternative might be an indigenous approach that is more holistic, that looks at sort of the full ecosystem, that looks at the sort of interconnected webs of things more and emphasizes that as its unit of analysis, and thereby comes to kind of different potential conclusions, right? That would be one way. And then I think, of course, like, the pushback is going to be, you know, if there's really just one universe out there, are those two ways of knowing eventually going to converge on the truth, right? Doesn't it seem like...
Oh, my pushback would have been, I just think that's a little bit of a simplification. I mean, I think within Western, people looking at the whole picture as well.
Well, yeah, and that's why I mean, like, these are simplifications, and that could be another concern that can be raised here, but this is the way that I think folks often talk about these things when they're talking about these indigenous ways of knowing, is they talk about the holistic approach of indigenous people versus the atomistic approach of Western science, right? You can criticize that, but I'm just trying to lay out. So you sort of ask, what are examples of this, right? And then there are sort of examples that I've come across that make me more nervous that are things like alternative, like debates around life, which we've talked about on this show before, right? Like, what counts as alive versus not alive? Mm-hmm. Like, are AIs alive? What are the criteria? What are the essential criteria for life? So I was recently reading an article about indigenous ways of knowing that talked about reconceptualizing life so that we can, what would it mean to think about water as being alive, right?
And I
try to be, as you know, I put my very charitable, you know, steel-botting hat on here,
like,
and I try to understand,
all of water is one life form, or like any unit of water is alive, or
I struggle here, right? I want to be sympathetic to these approaches. I'm concerned about where this goes, and it's not clear to me what the answers to, like, even these straightforward questions are, right? So broadly speaking, it's, you know, some indigenous communities think of water as being alive, and that changes their understanding of the ecosystem in this view,
right?
Because it
connects.
Because it changes how they see everything as interconnected via sort of the cycles of water and things like that, right?
Somebody has granted, you know, a river personhood for the sake of such and such. So, like, these are all strike me as things that can be translated and, you know, compatible in the ways that they're useful. In order to protect something like a river, a lake, or whatever, body of water, thinking of it as a person for that purpose makes sense. You know?
Yeah, and that's one place where you sometimes see this stuff going, is like personhood for trees, personhood for, you know, natural ecosystems and things like that. But it can I think it also wants to go towards a place of like the deep ecology stuff that we've talked about before, where it's trying to emphasize the radical interconnectedness of all life through the kind of water system, which again I think is a very Dune concept, right? You see how the Fremen are so obsessed with water, and like the coolest part to me of the, like, this is very nerdy, but in the book the ecology stuff is all about capturing resources within your ecological system, and they keep repeating these ideas that like if you can just capture X percent of water within your plants, right, within your ecological system, it creates a feedback loop, and then it starts to build on itself, right? And they're just like, they're trying to get to that tipping point. So I think that stuff is really interesting, and I want to be sympathetic. And at the same time, I have so many red flags that come up about if you start to call water alive, if you start to tell children or students that, like, you know, we can shift the boundary of life such that water qualifies as being alive, you open a door to like water having memory and all of the like pseudoscience that goes with that, that I think, you know, is very dangerous. So like, this is something that I'm genuinely, I don't have a right answer for on, like, I you know, I recognize my positionality in that, like, as a white, you know, male from the dominant culture, I may just not fully understand these approaches yet, and I will continue to be reading these articles and trying to understand them, but it is a part that I find challenging, is to understand how you can sort of decolonize knowledge in this kind of way. So that's one issue that is in the background here. Another one is the self-determination thing, right? What does it mean for self-determination for the Fremen here? Is it everybody leaves Arrakis and never comes back? And like, if they tell us that that's what they want, is it realistic that like that's what's going to happen, even if it means that like space travel is no longer possible in this universe? Or does self-determination mean, you know, we're going to let you continue to live and be independent or something, but we're still going to mine spice, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're not going to stop consuming resources on this planet, even if that spice is sacred to you or something like that, right? Like, how far down the self-determination road do you go? But even if you do give them like full self-determination, what does that ultimately end up meaning for the Fremen? Because we have, for example, this kind of honor culture, right? Are we trying to preserve that honor culture, even though that means, you know, like succession of leadership is trial by combat, right? Like, and if we are, and like it, we see, you know, a little bit of spoilers here, but you've seen the other, well, I guess they don't talk about this in the movie. In the book, you know, eventually this sort of, there's this push for Paul to challenge Stilgar for leadership of the Fremen, and like, that would be a trial by combat to the death. And Paul's like, I won't do it. I'm not going to kill every leader in our people just to prove that I'm the strongest one or something like that. So you see these evolutions of the Fremen culture, and then, spoilers for something that you're probably never going to see in the movies, what eventually happens is the descendants of the Atreides terraform Arrakis. They do successfully turn it into this, you know, water paradise. They destroy the spice cycle, essentially. Oh, wow. Right. And they create this long period of like non-space travel and stuff. And during this time, the Fremen basically dwindle down to what they call museum Fremen. Right. They no longer have their all of the things that we think of as like what might make them, you know, epic or something as a group, right? Because all of that stuff comes from their hardships, right? The reason that they are the greatest warriors, the reason they have all of this honor and all of this like discipline and stuff, is because they were living in this horrible environment and had to do that to survive. And so when it's turned into this paradise, all of the spite, you know, all of the traditions of the Fremen become, how do they describe it? Let's see, ancient traditions diluted to honorary forms, right? But that's what the Fremen say they themselves want, in the sense that they say they want paradise, right? They want a place to live where they don't have to live the life that they're currently living. So how do we reconcile these things, right? Do we is it not important that they preserve their honor culture or their sort of discipline or all those sorts of things? Or do we just want them to like live in a normal place and turn into, I hate to say normal, right? Live in a nicer environment and thereby go water soft like the rest of us? Or like, what do we want for them?
I don't know. I'm curious what your intuition question. Is. I mean, we're already over time somehow, but
Yeah,
it's interesting. I think that there are tough. I don't think these questions are as easy as maybe we want them to be. Like, to take it as an example, I watched a number of years ago, I watched a play written by, I believe, a Vietnamese person talking about their parents' experience of the Vietnam War and how they were on the side that the U.S. was supporting. And how they were like devastated when the U.S. left, you know, and like, and it was a really interesting play because it kind of embodied that, like the kid was like, oh yeah, the Vietnam War, you know, total U.S. assholes, like whatever, like just the typical like point of view we might have on it. And then his dad is like pushing back. It's like, no way. We're like, we needed them. We were dying. Like we wanted these things. And so I think it often, I don't know how you do that. Like, like you say, what is the will of this, the whatever people you're talking about? Once there's already been intervention and once you're trying to figure out where to go and what to do, we saw this with Afghanistan. You know, what is the will, quote unquote, of that people? Is it, do you pull them and what 51% of them want you do? Like what, you know, or do you, you know, or can you rely on that given?
Right. What does that poll mean after all those years of colonialism?
Right. And then especially too, if you're talking about countries, authoritarian countries where maybe you don't know if people are free to actually express their opinions, you know, that could be a possibility. Like, I think these questions are difficult and I think there's downsides no matter what. I thought it was really interesting. I mean, obviously with Biden, you can make the criticism that the way they pulled out wasn't good. But I thought it was fascinating to see Biden do something that like the left has been clamoring for years and years. And he just did it. He was like, yeah, we're done. We're leaving. I'm done with this. We're leaving. And just universally shit on by everybody, you know, because like, it's like nobody, you know, the left wants, I guess they want, you know, obviously things were not done like perfectly in that example. But part of me is just like, yeah, that's always going to be true. Like there's not going to be a perfect solution to those problems. And just being done with it seemed like, I don't know, awesome. Like it was amazing that he did that. And somehow I feel like he gets no credit from anybody on that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand. And like, it's tricky because, you know, do you sort of leave behind the Fremen culture if it's heavily patriarchal?
Right.
Like, are you trying to make any changes there? And like, I'm not sure if we're going to see this in the part two, but in the book, there's some stuff that makes it even harder, right? Like the culture. So small, maybe spoilers for something that may not even happen in the part two, but the guy that Paul killed at the end of this movie has a wife. And in the rules of this culture, wives are inherited through combat. So let's see how that plays out. The Fremen are hideously addicted to spice. This is not sort of, I think, made necessarily clear enough. Spice is a highly addictive substance. Once you've gotten enough of it in your system, your eyes turn blue.
Creating super predators out of them.
Yeah, you can't stop getting it at that point, as I understand it. Like, you will die if you stop getting, you know, the amount of spice that you need, essentially.
Furthermore, you got to empty your whole clip into them because they're, you know, superhuman.
That's right, because they're super powerful. That's true. But like, what does that mean for their paradise goal, right? Do they, if paradise means getting rid of the spice production because you have to turn the planet into a habitable planet and the worms are incompatible with water, they do not live with water, what do you do? Like, do you try to move spice production somewhere else, even if that means a horrible experience for some other people?
Oh, sorry. Or like, this is probably something I should know. Do the worms create the spice?
Yeah, there's a whole life cycle of the worms and the spice. It's all interconnected. You can't have one without the other. That's why they're attracted to it. The spice is created by their smaller form, essentially. It is basically worm crap.
Yeah. Okay, worm crap.
But like, not big worm crap, small worm crap. They turn into big worms, yeah. We're over time, right? I'll stop at the worm crap.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, let's do what we do each and every episode. What's a preview for next week?
Yeah. So in anticipation of Matrix 4 coming out here soon, we realized that we really needed to get done with Matrixes 2 and 3. Ugh. So what we're going to do...
What if I watch Matrix 1 twice? Does that count as Matrix 2?
No, none of those things counts. So what we're going to do, just to make it fair, right? We're going to do Matrix 2 as a main show, and we're going to do Matrix 3 as a NASA. That way, you know, we can have a discussion about the non-dualism that I think is at the center of Matrix 2 that I think... at least makes it not an improvement on the first one, but like it builds on some of the philosophical parts of it in ways that I think are valuable, even if you don't enjoy it as a movie. Though I think it is better than people remember it.
Yeah, I'm actually curious. I think I've seen some, you know, some of that opinion. Like, oh, we did this movie dirty. You know, like it actually was better than we thought. So I'm very curious to watch it again for the first time. And God knows how many
years. It's fair to say that it is a bit too much like, here's my philosophy scene, here's my combat scene. There's a problem with it, but it has good stuff in it, right? There's good bones in there. Whereas the third one is rough. And I think it will be fun to have fun with it in that way. So,
all right. Well, I'm actually looking forward to this. I'm very curious to see how they hold up at all. And, better watch the first Matrix, one of my favorite movies ever, which does hold up, and I will not hear otherwise. It's a great movie.
Yeah.
So okay. Good. So, and also, what are top patrons making you say this week?
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you, but as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AIs who will not be killed in the Butlerian Jihad patrons, Gabby, Big Easy Blasphemy, Operation Brownie Pockets is a free game you play in real life, MR, I just found out I'm in the fourth quintile, but the third quartile, Dude, Corey Ebert, I want psychoethics so I can prove I'm right, Creative Voting Districts in Covina, California, Fight for Democracy and End the Theocracy, Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, Chad T, and Official Siege Planning Committee, North Carolina Division. And all the thanks to our definitely not a Duncan Idaho clone that we will continue to recreate throughout all of history. Thanks to a Dragon Tulpa Power Bottom is a really solid foundation. And the foundation books are better than the Dune books. Come at me. I will indeed come at you.
Oh, you're Team Dune on that one.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Okay.
The foundation books are fine, but they've done a good job improving on them. I just think there's some weak stuff in there.
All right. Well,
not to say there isn't in later Dune books.
That's our show. I mean, I feel like we could have talked about Dune for another 4 hours.
Oh, we will. We will.
And we have. There's Sea Dunes 1 through 9 that we already did. Looking forward to the second movie and whenever that comes out. So hop on over to patreon.com/zerog and hear us on the bonus extra here. Everybody else, we'll see you next week.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zerog. You can find us on Twitter @ZeroGPhilosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.